Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V20 6-Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Stop by your nearest Lowe's store and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Slide 33.
So this is back in Idaho, showing the usage of the number ending 4652 on October the 2nd from 8:50 in the morning to 9:46 in the morning, sticking with Arizona time based on the fact that there was an incident that occurred in Arizona. So between 8:50 and 9:45, there's five instances where that phone is on the network and utilizing a tower and sector consistent with providing coverage to Lori Vallow's apartment. And there's two outgoing calls, three incoming calls. There's one outgoing call to the number ending 8587, which was associated with Melanie Boudreau. That call's a 35-minute call. And then there's one outgoing and three incomings with 0143. That number I had associated with Chad Daybell.
So since this is Arizona time, at 8:53, this would be before the shooting occurred in Arizona, if that occurred at 9:13.
Yes, ma'am, correct.
Okay. So prior to the shooting in Arizona, we have an outgoing call to the number associated to Chad Daybell?
Yes, ma'am, at 8:50.
And then an outgoing call associated to a phone for Melanie Boudreau. And then an incoming call associated to the number for Chad Daybell at 9:01.
Yes, ma'am.
And then there is a break in time before there is an additional incoming call at 9:44 and 9:45, both of those from the phone associated to Chad Daybell.
Correct. And I would just point out that that one call at 853, that's an outbound call to the number associated with Melanie Boudreau, is a 35-minute call. So it could have spanned a large portion of that time window.
So when we see the incoming call at 901, how does that work if she's on the phone outgoing?
I'd need to look at the specific call detail record, but that very well could just be call waiting to where both calls occurred during that same time window, but I wouldn't be able to answer that question with the records I have in front of me.
That call is just 2 minutes, 209?
Yes, ma'am.
And then when we see the 944, we see that's just a 3 second initial call, and then at 945, a 7.5 minute call?
Yes, ma'am, correct.
Slide 34, what are we seeing here?
So now we're zoomed out again because we're showing two vastly different locations of where towers that were utilized by the 5998 phone were. So we're looking at October 2nd between 1:22 p.m. and 8:13 p.m. Starting at 1:22, the 5998 phone is utilizing a tower and sector in Arizona, kind of northeast of Phoenix. And then by 7:53, the phone is utilizing a tower and sector in Utah.
When you're looking at this and you reviewed the records, the call that we see at 8:12 p.m. incoming from the phone associated to Chad Daybell, that's a 29, almost 30-minute call?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that the last call that is documented for this Walmart track phone from Idaho Falls?
There are additional calls, but I'll explain it like this. So whenever you're looking at a call detail record, if there's an incoming call and then there's duration and there's a tower and sector identified, that shows that that phone was on the network and we can show that that call connected. There's additional calls after that that don't populate those columns that would be associated with the tower. And so because of that, you could have incoming calls that would just basically go straight to voicemail because that phone is no longer on the network. So the 8:12 p.m. was the last record I saw on the call detail record where the phone was on the network to receive a call.
Okay. So slide 35, what state are we in? What are we seeing here?
So we're back in Rexburg, Idaho. And we're looking at October 3rd, 2019 at approximately 2:15 p.m. The 9120 phone is reporting its location to Google, consistent with being in the area of the self-storage plus.
And so we see 2:15 p.m. Wi-Fi data of that phone associated to Alex Cox at the self-storage unit?
Yes, ma'am, correct.
And then were you also provided with video to show that at 2:13 p.m. There are two individuals removing a tire and another item, a bench seat, from the storage unit that was rented by Lori Vallow?
Yes, ma'am.
Slide 36, what does this show us?
So this is showing use of the 4652 phone, October the 3rd, 2019, between 2:20 and 2:22. And the phone is using a tower and sector that would provide coverage to the apartment complex for both Lori and Alex.
So on October 3rd, we now have the phone associated to Lori Vallow, receiving calls from the phone that has been associated to Chad Daybell.
Yes, ma'am.
And that phone is using a tower consistent with them being in Rexburg, Idaho.
Yes, ma'am.
Were there any other network calls that you saw for that phone from the Walmart Idaho Falls track phone?
No, not after the call that was made in Utah.
And did that end your mapping of the data provided to you by the Gilbert Police Department in relation to this case?
Yes, ma'am, it did.
State has no other questions for this witness.
All right, cross.
Do you want me to call you Special Agent or Mr. Balance or?
Special Agent is fine.
Okay. Special Agent Balance, I just have a couple questions. You had mentioned that if all of your, you had mentioned if all of your locations are on, which one would it track? So say you have three phones associated to your Gmail account and all the locations are on, what would it be tracking?
Yeah, so if you were to look at the location history where you had three different devices that were reporting that location, whenever you look at the record, they have a column called device tag.
Okay.
So they would differentiate that device tag. That's a number Google provides, but that device tag would be associated with each individual device. So as an example, if you were looking at, you only wanted to see the Google location for phone one, you would need to know the device tag associated with phone one, and you could filter out and see just where that device was. Same thing with phone two or phone three, depending on how many devices are reporting location information.
So if all three had their location on, then all three would be reported, even if they were in different locations?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct.
Okay. And then what about if you have, so you're talking about a track phone being connected to a Gmail account, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And then what if you have an iPad, a laptop, and a phone all connected to the same Gmail account?
So it would depend on, again, that device tag column and the device itself. So the device would need to be able to report location information. Google would need to be able to derive that location information by some method. So if you had location information turned on all those different devices, it would really just depend on the device, how it reports it, but it would show up in that same location history record.
So if you're tracking something and you say phone one, you don't want the iPad, you don't want the laptop, you're tracking phone one, you would be able to distinguish that out by that number of phone one?
So I would look in the Google record, the entirety of the record, it would tell you which device tag is associated with which device. And so then I could differentiate which device was being reported and which ones weren't.
Now, where did you get your, who sent you the information from Google? Did you get that directly from Google? I had missed that.
No, so those records were obtained via a search warrant. I believe it was somebody from the investigative team in Rexburg.
Okay.
But I wouldn't be able to provide you a name of who sent those records down.
And how did those records come to you? Like an email or something? Or how?
Yes, ma'am. They would usually be sent via email.
So is that like, it's a lot of data, right? So is it one giant email or several emails? How does that work?
It depends. Specific to this case, I can't remember whether it was sent via email, but we do have options to send larger files. And so if it's a Google record that has location history, has a bunch of different services that are being utilized by that user, it could be a very large file, and then it would be sent electronically to me.
Through like a hard drive or a flash drive, something to that effect?
We have some ways that we can send it electronically that they're capable of transferring larger files, per se.
And so the data that you received from this email or from a larger, did you receive it from an email? You don't remember if you received it from an email, is that correct?
I don't recall. I would say that given this particular file, I know it was larger, so I would guess that it probably came via some type of transferring platform versus email.
Okay. And then if you don't know who you got it from, how do you know if that information is accurate?
So I'm basically mapping out records as I receive them. So I would look at the certificate of authenticity. I would ensure that it's a record that came from Google. But aside from that, I'm mapping records as I receive them.
So you don't have any way to know if it was altered before it got to you, basically?
Correct.
Okay. And you're saying that you're getting all of your information directly from Google. So would it be different information if you had the phone itself? Or are you getting all the information from Google that you would have with this phone?
So with CAST and the specific unit that I'm assigned to, we're not looking at information that comes out of the device. We're looking at the records that were generated with particular providers. So although we might could get information additionally from the forensic download of a phone, what we're looking at is those records from the providers that are maintained separate from the phone, if that answers your question.
So my question is, would you have more information if you had the phone?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so you could track it better per se.
I wouldn't say better. I would just say that you could potentially have more information that would help determine whether the records are consistent with the overall picture of what both the carrier records are showing and what the phone records are showing. So as an example, my phone right now, if I'm sending text messages back and forth, those messages have content, they have context of, you know, if I say I'm on the way to the airport or I'm going to leave here in 10 minutes. Separate from that, you have the records from Verizon that would show feasibly where my phone was. Now, if you marry those records up, you definitely have more information and you could tell the story better, but one's not necessarily better. It just depends on the circumstance.
So one doesn't negate the other, it just confirms it.
Sure.
Okay. So is it typical, would you say, for people to have more than one device associated to their email?
Yeah, this day and age, I would say so, just because a lot of people have more than one phone.
And you could have multiple devices, like 5 iPads and 5 phones and a couple computers, all generated and giving Google information from the same Google email?
Sure. It depends on what your... it's going to be dependent on every single individual. But yeah, if you have an iPad, a laptop, a phone, and you connect all those to your Google account, like, it's not unreasonable for me to see records associated with multiple devices that have accessed a Google account.
Okay. And you can't put a person anywhere, right?
So anytime I'm estimating a location of a device, it's not an estimated location of a person, it's an estimated location of a device. And it really depends on the records that I obtain. So while I've been very successful in determining a location of an individual based on their device, it depends on the records of whether that search area is smaller or larger.
Okay. So if you were to give a teenager a phone with associated to your email account, and they're at an amusement park going on a bunch of rides, and then you're doing a download, it could look like you were in all these places, but you were really not. Is that true?
Can you rephrase that question a little bit?
So if you just had a track phone that was associated to your Gmail account and anyone else had it, it would look like you were in that place.
So the device, if the device is reporting to Google its location information, then I would look at those locations that it's reported as the areas where that phone was at a particular date and time.
Right. So you can't put a person anywhere, but you are locating the device. Is that correct?
Correct. I'm locating a device.
Okay. Do you remember about what... you had said that on October 3rd at 2:15, the device was at the self-storage plus. Was that the track phone?
No, that was the number ending 9120. So that was reporting its location to Google as being consistent with being at the self-storage plus.
And did the track phone ever, I want to say ping, but give a location in Rexburg after October 3rd?
Not after October 3rd, no ma'am.
Do you remember the last time when it did?
I know the last time in the call detail record was that page where it showed the phone being used in Utah, and I believe that was October the 2nd, towards the evening hours.
Do you know where in Utah that last location was?
If you were to pull up that page on the report, I could give you the area, but I know it was southeast of Salt Lake City.
Okay. There was something about the meters. So when you were talking about on page 6, you show the three slides with the sectors.
Okay, are you able to pull up page 6?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sure.
No, you're fine.
It's okay if I just hand it to him. Or do you want it? You can put it on the list. You want it on here?
Yeah. Oh.
Roll.
There we go.
The other way.
There we go.
Sorry. I just wanted to ask a question about the meters.
Sure.
So you had said something about, is it 150 meters in each of those sectors? Was that what I heard?
So it's degrees instead of meters. So basically what you're looking at is how a sector is divided up of a tower. And so specific to this one, I think I was mentioning sector 1. And when you talk about the azimuth or direction from the tower that that particular sector is facing, you would use that azimuth in degrees to give you that direction.
So with the two apartments being so close in proximity, and you are talking about that it's pinging on a cell tower that shows both. So I'll show you this one. I think it's this one. 18. So this circle right here, can that's both apartments are within that same, is that cell phone coverage?
So that specific graphic there, when you're looking at that circle, all that circle is doing is showing the direction from the tower of where that specific sector is providing coverage to. So in this instance, that tower, that sector is facing northwest, and that particular and tower and sector is providing coverage to a great deal of Rexburg, but included in that coverage would be the apartment complex for both Alex and yourself.
And so do you know how far apart those apartments actually are?
I know they're fairly meters. Close. It's been a while since I've been out there. It's been a while, but I know there was maybe one to two buildings between, but they were relatively close.
So are you able to tell from location-wise, are you able to tell the difference with a cell phone tower, or is it some other way that you're... Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay.
So with this particular in tower and sector, that usage at 1131, there's no way you could say definitively that that phone was at Alex's apartment, was at your apartment. You're just basically saying that's utilizing a tower and sector that provides coverage to that area. So the phone could be anywhere within that coverage area whenever that particular call was made.
Okay. But there is a way to distinguish if it was at either one, but it's not that cell phone tower.
Not via the call detail records from Verizon. You would need the Google location history, which is giving a much tighter margin of error associated with that device.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. So when you had spoke about the Walmart, I don't know what page that is, but you were showing that according to Google, is that correct, that a phone associated with me and a phone associated with Alex were in that Walmart shopping center?
So correct? I think you're talking about page 16. So there's two different pages associated with that statement. The first one is the 9120 phone reporting its location to Google, and that's where you can see multiple locations consistent with being at that Walmart in Idaho Falls. The page following that is looking at the phone associated with you that was utilizing a tower and sector that would provide coverage to the general area of that Walmart. So it's two different, basically, versions of records that are providing two different estimates as to where those two phones were.
Because one is a phone call, so it has an outgoing tower. Is that correct?
So one is looking at the Verizon network, and so it's utilizing that specific tower and sector for that. I can't remember whether it was an incoming or an outgoing call. Whereas the Google location, that's information that that phone is reporting from either GPS or Wi-Fi to Google as where it's located during that same time period.
So could it connect to Walmart Wi-Fi? Does Walmart have a Wi-Fi?
So it wouldn't need to. If Walmart had a Wi-Fi, it doesn't necessarily need to connect to it. It just needs to see it. Because when the phone takes a measurement and sees that it's has a certain signal strength from that Walmart Wi-Fi, then it is able to estimate where that phone is because Google knows where that particular Wi-Fi hotspot is located.
Do you have the ability to track someone walking around in a Walmart?
I mean, if you looked at the Google, if you're looking historically and you wanted to see, like, did an individual go to a particular aisle in Walmart, I think that would be a stretch, unless it's a very big Walmart and you're just trying to see whether they were in landscaping or over on the grocery side. It all depends on the information that you have in that record from Google. So if those margins of error are super small, you could potentially estimate that. But it really would just depend on the record that you have specific to the device that you're trying to locate.
And if you had the actual device, could you pinpoint that more accurately?
Again, it would depend on the device and what apps you're running on the device and what all is being potentially stored. So different phones have different ways that they store information. They have different GPS chips inside of them. Apps have different ways that they store information. And so it would really just depend on getting that phone, doing a forensic download of that phone, and seeing what you have.
And then could you compare that to the Google information that you got and have a much more accurate picture?
I wouldn't say you would always have a more accurate picture because you might not have any records that you might do a forensic download and you're not able to pull out any location information. I would say that it's always better to have more information to do that comparison, but it's not a guarantee that it's going to make it better by having the forensic download of the phone.
So it would be more accurate as far as locations from Google?
I wouldn't say it'd be more accurate. It's just, it's a different record, you know? So if you have a Google location record that has a significant number of locations, they're all 2-3 meter hits because you were potentially standing outside, that's gonna be pretty precise. But it's kind of speaking in It really just depends because you don't know what that record's going to look like until you get it and you review it.
So if you don't have your location on, are you able to track where things are or only if it connects to a Wi-Fi?
So again, it's going to depend on the specific app that you're speaking about. So like if you go into your phone, you can turn location services on or off for a lot of different apps. And so whenever I'm evaluating records from places like Google or different applications that have stored that location data. So it really just depends on how you have your specific phone set up and what you've opted into or out of as far as location sharing.
Okay. So basically your report is indicative of phones associated to certain emails in certain locations at certain times.
So the one phone is associated with the Gmail account. That's the 9120.
Okay.
The other two phones are, I'm looking at Verizon records. So it's okay. Basically what Verizon maintained for those specific numbers.
And is one more specific than the other, the one with Gmail or the two with Verizon?
I would say that the locations being reported to Google had smaller areas to estimate where the device was. When you're talking about the Verizon records, the records that I had, I'm only able to estimate a general area based on what the coverage of a particular tower and sector provides coverage to.
Okay, and what is the radius of that, the tower coverage of Verizon?
So if you go back to some of my earlier statements, it's gonna depend on where you're located. So downtown Phoenix, tower density follows population density. So the coverage areas in downtown Phoenix are gonna be a lot smaller than if you get out into rural areas where there's just not as many users. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, that coverage area is gonna be large. Typically, I estimate that the coverage area of a tower is going to be the area between that tower and the next tower closest to it.
So with the Verizon records, that was the one that would say 16 meters or 15 meters. Was that with the Verizon records?
No, that would have been the Google location if it's what I think you're referring to, where there's a margin of error with a circle around it. That's mm-hmm. solely from Google. That would not be from Verizon.
Okay, so with Verizon, it's more accurate. And with Google, it's with the meters, within a certain amount of meters?
It's the way that they're measuring. Google's providing their margin of error. Verizon is not. For Verizon, when we're estimating a coverage area, I'm using my training and experience of locating phones historically and estimating that that phone, what the coverage area is going to be for the tower and sector that that phone used.
So is it which one, the Gmail or the Verizon, that is giving you the information that there was no moving of the phone from one apartment to the other?
So whenever I made that statement, it's based off the Google location history. And so what I'm looking at is for a period of time, every Google location, every line in that Google location history record. So whenever I'm looking at those and I don't see that that device has either moved or gone to Alex Cox's apartment, that's all from the Google location record.
Right. So if a phone was just in a car driving around, right, then it would show it in movement everywhere that car went?
It would depend on if it's reporting its location during that movement. So let's say, for instance, that car left a parking lot of that apartment complex and drove 15 minutes north and then 15 minutes back. As long as there's a Google location record during that 30-minute window, that's where I would be able to say that there was movement. But if there's a record at 9 o'clock in the morning and then there's not another record until 9:30, I can't say definitively that that phone didn't move during that 30-minute window. All I can say is this is where it was at 9 o'clock, and this is where it was at 9:30.
Because it's not reporting.
Correct. Okay. Every estimate that I make is based on there has to be a record in a line of a record for me to determine a potential location.
So can you explain that to me, what it's reporting? So if a phone is off, it's not going to be reporting anything. But if it's just sitting there stagnant, it's not going to be reporting anything?
It depends. Typically, I've seen in records that I've reviewed on a regular basis, if a phone is stationary, it's not going to report as much. And if it's moving, it potentially would report more. But again, the phone has to be on and the phone has to be opted into location history. And that's what's going to generate that record that's maintained by Google that I can then evaluate and see potentially where a phone was in the past.
Okay, so you have access to what is being reported.
So I would have access to the Google location record.
Right, only what the phone is reporting or what the device is reporting.
To Google, yes.
Okay. And you made your report off of what was reported, and it's not, I'm just trying to get to, it's not constant. You're not getting a phone record from, like, say, September all the way through October, and you know everything of where that went, because it wouldn't be reporting all that time. Is that accurate?
So I'll give you an analogy. Maybe this will potentially help, but if you think about, you live next door to your neighbor, and your neighbor's car is in the driveway. They've got a red car in the driveway. And so at 9:02 in the morning, you go and look, the neighbor's car is in the driveway. 9:45, you go and look, and the neighbor's car is in the driveway. And then one more time at, say, 11 o'clock, you look, and the neighbor's car is in the driveway. You can only say that the neighbor's car was in the driveway at those specific instances, because that's when you looked out the window. You could reason that maybe that car was there the entire time, but you can only definitively say where that car was when you have an instance that you looked out the window. So it's the same thing with the Google location record. So I can estimate where a device was as long as there's a date and time, a latitude and longitude, and a margin of error. If that's not present, then I'm not able to estimate during the window of inactivity where that device is.
So in your timeline, there could be blind spots where you don't know where the phone was or the device was or what it was doing.
If there's not a location record, I can't map it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Redirect.
So, Detective, in your years working as a CAST agent, have you reviewed multiple Google records?
Yes, ma'am.
Verizon records?
Yes, ma'am.
Track phone records?
Yes, ma'am.
And you told us that part of your process is to always look at the certificate of authenticity?
Yes, ma'am.
Was that done here?
Yes, ma'am.
Did anything about these records appear to be unauthentic or modified?
No, ma'am.
When you are mapping and creating these maps for us, are you just using the data and just showing us what it says?
Yes, ma'am.
In this case, you were given Alex Cox's Google or Gmail records for the HomerJMaximus.com, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And that included location data?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were provided with records showing that that Gmail account was associated to the 9120 number?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were also provided, and those Google records is what gave us the GPS and the Wi-Fi location data for that cell phone, 480-351-9120.
Yes, ma'am.
Then you also had the Walmart track phone, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
That phone was not reporting Wi-Fi or GPS data. You did not have any for that phone.
No, that phone was not reporting any location information to Google.
But based upon the Google records you had for the HomerJMaximus@gmail.com, you were able to determine that Walmart track phone had accessed and associated with that HomerJMaximus@gmail.com address.
Yes, ma'am. That phone accessed that Gmail account.
Okay. So when you're talking about the Walmart track phone, all you were able to map on that was cell tower use.
Yes, records from Verizon.
When we talk about the Walmart on September 25th of 2019, We have both the phone associated with Alex Cox, the 9120 phone that you mapped there, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And that mapping was, again, using the GPS and Wi-Fi?
Yes, ma'am, as reported to Google.
And that was, you were able to map that within as small as 16-meter radius?
I believe that's correct, but I'd have to look at the page to ensure the margin of error.
Just going to throw this one up to make it faster.
Yeah, so the most precise was the 16 meters.
So it's in the Walmart.
It's consistent with being in the Walmart.
So unless the Walmart's smaller than 16 meters, pretty likely it's there, especially given the number of hits that you had in that location.
I'll say that if I were looking for that device and it was, you know, 7:15 right now, and that's the records that I was seeing, I would go inside the Walmart to look for that phone.
Okay. Now, on the other hand, you also had cell tower usage for the phone number associated, or for the phone associated to Lori Vallow, the 4652 number, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And you did not have GPS or Wi-Fi for that?
Correct. That phone was never reporting location information to Google that I had.
So for that case, you were using cell tower data?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were able to determine that that phone was using a cell tower in the area of the Walmart at the same time as this phone is showing G or Wi-Fi location data at the Walmart?
Yeah, I think that was at 7:08 p.m. if I remember right.
So it would be in this time frame of 7:07 to 7:16?
Yes, ma'am, correct.
And we see over there 7:08. So basically both of those two phones, the phone associated to Alex Cox and the phone associated to Lori Vallow, are either showing specifically Wi-Fi location data in the area of the Walmart or using a cell tower in the area of the Walmart.
Correct.
I have no other questions for this witness.
Are there any questions for this witness from any member of the jury? I don't see any. Sir, you can step down.
Your Honor, at this time, the state is going to rest.
All right, the state has rested. That means the state's done with its presentation of the evidence in this case. At this time, we'll take our noon recess. Please be back in the jury room, ready to go at about 1:20 p.m., please. 1:20 p.m., please remember the admonition.
All rise for the jury.
Does the defendant intend on putting on a case? Any witnesses or testifying?
We plan on doing our Rule 20, Your Honor, and no.
Okay. Go ahead with your Rule 20.
Can we do that when we get back from lunch?
Sure. If you're telling me you don't plan on testifying or you don't plan on calling witnesses, let's finalize the jury instructions, though, right now. Did you get a chance to look at those?
We did.
All right. Let me go to the state first. Why don't we do it this way? We'll just go through one page at a time to make sure everyone's on the same page. So the cover page, then page two is duty of the court, evidence to be considered, rulings of the court. Those are standard. Any objections to those from the state?
Hi, Your Honor.
Defense?
No.
Page three, direct and circumstantial evidence, redacted exhibits, indictment, not evidence, self-represented defendant. Any objection to those from the state?
No, Your Honor.
From the defense?
No. No.
I'm sorry. Okay. Page four, comments are not evidence. That was modified a little bit because the defendant represents herself. Credibility of witnesses, testimony of law enforcement officers, expert witnesses. Any objection to those from the state?
No.
Defense?
No objection.
Page 5, defendant need not produce evidence, defendant need not testify, voluntariness of defendant's statements, and then the start of the jury not to consider penalty. Again, all standard. Any objections from the state?
Judge, we actually have no statements by the defendant, so
That's true. We could probably delete that. I think that's right. There were no statements, so I would intend on deleting that. Anything else from the state?
No, Your Honor.
How about from the defense?
No, we agree.
You agree that that should be deleted?
Correct.
Okay. Page 6, presumption of innocence, burden of proof, evidence of any kind, voluntary act. Any objection to those from the state?
No.
Defense?
No objection.
Page 7, the absence of other participant, motive, and then the charged offense starts with the charged offense and then defines what is first degree premeditated murder. Any objections from the state?
No.
From the defense?
No objection.
All right. Page 8, a definition of premeditation. Then we have the elements of conspiracy, scope of proof of conspiracy, and proof of membership in a conspiracy. Any objection to those from the state?
No.
Defense?
No objection.
Page 9, definitions, intentionally, knowingly. A part of the accomplice. Any objection to those from the state?
No.
Defense?
No objection.
Then top of page 10, accomplice, act, and I don't know why aggravated assault. I must have left that in from the last one. I'm going to delete aggravated assault. I think that was on the crime prevention from our last trial, so my mistake on having that in there. I'll delete that. Other than that, any objections from the state?
No.
Defense?
No objection.
And then we have the jury foreperson and the closing instruction. Any objection to those?
No.
Defense?
No objection.
And then we have a form of verdict. Any objection to that from the state?
No.
Defense?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No objection to it.
All right. Any others that I haven't included that the state is requesting?
No, Your Honor.
Defense?
Your Honor, we would ask for mere presence just because they put up the videos of me being at the storage unit at that time.
Well, mere presence would apply to the crime scene itself.
I understand that, but I think it would cover it.
I don't think it's applicable, but I don't mind including it if the state agrees with the state's.
Given it's the conspiracy to be safe, I'm fine including
okay,
it in
we'll
there, Judge.
Add mere presence back. I think I had it last time. Mm-hmm. I will probably put that how about if I put that right behind absence of other participant before motive? In that area it makes sense, I think.
That's fine.
All right, any other additions?
That's
all right,
it,
so when we come back from lunch at 1:20, the defendant will do her Rule 20 motion. When the jury comes back in, I'll turn to the defendant who is telling me she's going to rest her case at that time, and I'll read the instructions, go right into closing arguments. All right, thank you.
All right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, we're back on the record. State of Arizona versus Dave L. Sierra, 2022-001242. The parties are present. Ms. Daybell, go ahead.
With the Rule 20, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Okay. The court must enter a judgment of acquittal on any offense charged in an indictment if there is no substantial evidence to support a conviction. Conspiracy to commit first-degree murder requires the state prove that I, one, agreed with another, in this case Alex, that one or more of us would engage in conduct that equaled first-degree murder.
and two, that I intended to promote or assist in the conduct. The only evidence that has been presented simply establishes that I have been seen on video placing items into a storage unit. A phone that is connected to me through an email made phone calls during this time frame, and a Google search relating to Gilbert, Arizona. None of this evidence establishes that I agreed with Alex Cox to engage in conduct that equals first degree. The state has the burden of establishing all elements of an offense have been committed, and thus there is not substantial evidence to support a conviction.
All right. Does the state want to respond for the record?
Sure. Looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, there is substantial evidence for a jury to find the defendant guilty of conspiring with Alex Cox to commit first-degree murder of Brandon Boudreau. In this case, in determining if a conspiracy existed, the jury can look at the fact that the defendant went with Alex Cox to buy the burner phone, that she loaned her Jeep to him to be used, that she rented a storage unit, that she Googled how to remove the rear seat, that she hid the tire and seat, and that she created an alibi for her brother by having those two phones interact while he was in Gilbert, Arizona.
All right. The standard is whether a reasonable juror could find the defendant guilty, whether there's substantial evidence that a reasonable juror could find the defendant guilty. The state has presented a compelling case that Alex Cox traveled to Gilbert, Arizona and attempted to kill Mr. Boudreau. There's other circumstantial evidence that establishes that the defendant was aware of Mr. Cox's plans and facilitated those plans and assisted in those plans in several different ways. It's ordered denying the motion for Rule 20. Anything else? All right, just confirming that the defendant doesn't intend on testifying or calling any witnesses?
Correct. I would like to again just admit the letter from Tammy. It was marked.
Did we
just wanted
marked?
To let you know that.
Yeah. Okay, 203, for purposes of maintaining the record and any appeal issues, 203 would be admitted for the record, but not to the jury. Anything else? All right, let's bring the jurors in. I'll turn to the defendant when the jury sat, and the defendant presumably will say that she rests as well. Thank you. Be seated when you get to your seat. All right, thank you. The jury is now present. Everyone can be seated. The defense has rested before lunch. The state rested before lunch. I'll now turn to the defense.
The defense also rests, Your Honor.
All right, at this time, we are going to hand out the final jury instructions. My assistant will hand those to the jurors. Do the parties already have their copies?
Yes.
Okay. All right, it looks like all jurors have copies of the final jury instructions. Much like the preliminary instructions, you're free to follow along or just listen. I'm going to read these instructions as required. It is your duty as a juror to decide this case by applying these jury instructions to the facts as you determine them. You must follow these jury instructions. They are the rules you should use to decide this case. It is your duty to determine what the facts are in the case by determining what actually happened. Determine the facts only from the evidence produced in court. When I say evidence, I mean the testimony of witnesses and the exhibits introduced in court. You should not guess about any fact. You must not be influenced by sympathy or prejudice. You must not be concerned with any opinion that you feel I have about the facts. You, as jurors, are the sole judges of what happened. You must consider all these instructions. Do not pick out one instruction or part of one and ignore the others. As you determine the facts, however, you may find that some instructions no longer apply. You must then consider the instructions that do apply together with the facts as you have determined them. You are to determine what the facts in the case are from the evidence produced in court. If the court sustained an objection to a lawyer's question, you must disregard it and any answer given. Any testimony stricken from the court record must not be considered. Admission of evidence in court is governed by rules of law. I've applied those rules during the trial and resolved any issues concerning the admission of evidence. If an objection to a question was sustained, you must disregard the question and you must not guess what the answer to the question might have been. If an exhibit was offered into evidence and an objection to it was sustained, you must not consider that exhibit as evidence. If testimony was ordered stricken from the record, you must not consider that testimony for any purpose. If evidence was admitted for a limited purpose, you shall consider that evidence only for that limited purpose. Do not concern yourselves with the reasons for my rulings on the admission of evidence. Do not regard those rulings as any indication from me of the credibility or weight you should give to any evidence that has been admitted. Evidence may be direct or circumstantial. Direct evidence is the testimony of a witness who saw, heard, or otherwise sensed an event. Circumstantial evidence is the proof of a fact or facts from which you may find another fact. The law makes no distinction between direct and circumstantial evidence. It is for you to determine the importance to be given to the evidence, regardless of whether it is direct or circumstantial. Some of the exhibits that have been admitted into evidence have had portions deleted from them for legal reasons. Do not concern yourselves with the reasons why some portions of the exhibits have been deleted. Do not speculate upon what the deleted portions might or might not reveal. The state has charged the defendant with a crime. A charge is not evidence against the defendant. You must not think the defendant is guilty just because of a charge. The defendant has pled not guilty. This plea of not guilty means that the state must prove each element of the charge beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant in this case represents herself. All instructions I read to you that include references to lawyers or attorneys apply equally to the defendant's self-representation at trial. The defendant's decision to represent herself should not be considered by you in determining the facts. In their opening statements, the prosecutor and the defendant talk to you about the law and the evidence. In a few minutes, the prosecutor and the defendant will give their closing arguments and will talk about the law and the evidence. What they said or say is not evidence because it is not sworn testimony, but it may help you to understand the law and the evidence. In deciding the facts of this case, you should consider what testimony to accept and what to reject. You may accept everything a witness says, or part of it, or none of it. In evaluating testimony, you should use the test for truthfulness that people use in determining matters of importance in everyday life, including such factors as the witness's ability to see or hear or know the things the witness testified to, the quality of the witness's memory, the witness's manner while testifying, whether the witness had any motive, bias, or prejudice, whether the witness was contradicted by anything the witness said or wrote before a trial or by other evidence, and the reasonableness of the witness's testimony when considered in the light of the other evidence. Consider all of the evidence in the light of reason, common sense, and experience. The testimony of a law enforcement officer is not entitled to any greater or lesser importance or believability merely because of the fact that the witness is a law enforcement officer. You are to consider the testimony of a police officer just as you would the testimony of any other witness. A witness qualified as an expert by education or experience may state opinions on matters in that witness's field of expertise and may also state reasons for those opinions. Expert opinion testimony should be judged just as any other testimony. You are not bound by it. You may accept it or reject it in whole or in part, and you should give it as much credibility and weight as you think it deserves, considering the witness's qualifications and experience, the reasons given for the opinions, and all the other evidence in the case. The state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence. The defendant is not required to produce evidence of any kind. the defendant's decision not to produce any evidence is not evidence of guilt. The state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence. You must not conclude that the defendant is likely to be guilty because the defendant did not testify. The defendant is not required to testify. The decision on whether or not to testify is left to the defendant. You must not let this choice affect your deliberations in any way. You must decide whether a defendant is guilty or not guilty by determining what the facts in the case are and applying these jury instructions. You must not consider the possible punishment when deciding on guilt. Punishment is left to the judge. The law does not require a defendant to prove innocence. Every defendant is presumed by law to be innocent. You must start with the presumption that the defendant is innocent. The state has the burden of proving the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This means the state must prove each element of the charge beyond a reasonable doubt. In civil cases, it is only necessary to prove that a fact is more likely true than not, or that its truth is highly probable. In criminal cases such as this, the state's proof must be more powerful than that. It must be beyond a reasonable doubt. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced of the defendant's guilt. There are very few things in this world that we know with absolute certainty, and in criminal cases, the law does not require proof that overcomes every doubt. If, based on your consideration of the evidence, you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charged, you must find her guilty. If, on the other hand, you think there is a real possibility that she is not guilty, you must give her the benefit of the doubt and find her not guilty. The state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence. The defendant is not required to produce evidence of any kind. The decision on whether to produce any evidence is left to the defendant. The defendant's decision not to produce evidence is not evidence of guilt. Before you may convict the defendant of the charged crime, you must find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed a voluntary act. A voluntary act means a bodily movement performed consciously and as a result of effort and determination. You must consider all the evidence in deciding whether the defendant committed the act voluntarily. The only matter for you to determine is whether the state has proved the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant's guilt or innocence is not affected by the fact that another person or persons might have participated or cooperated in the crime and is not on trial now. You should not guess about the reason any other person is absent from the courtroom. Guilt cannot be established by the defendant's mere presence at a crime scene, mere association with another person at a crime scene, or mere knowledge that a crime is being committed. The fact that the defendant may have been present or knew that a crime was being committed does not in and of itself make the defendant guilty of the crime charged. One who is merely present is a passive observer who lacked criminal intent and did not participate in the crime. The state need not prove motive, but you may consider motive or lack of motive in reaching your verdict. I will now tell you about the crime with which the defendant is charged. Count one, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. The crime of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder requires proof that the defendant, on or about October 2nd, 2019, with the intent to promote or aid in the commission of first-degree murder, agreed with Alexander Cox that at least one of them or another would engage in conduct constituting the offense of first-degree murder. The crime of first-degree premeditated murder requires proof that a person, one, caused the death of another person, and two, intended or knew that he or she would cause the death of another person, and three, acted with premeditation. Premeditation means that the defendant intended to kill another human being or knew she or a co-conspirator would kill another human being, and that after forming that intent or knowledge, reflected on the decision before killing. It is this reflection, regardless of the length of time in which it occurs, that distinguishes first-degree murder from second-degree murder. An act is not done with premeditation if it is the instant effect of a sudden quarrel or heat of passion. The time needed for reflection is not necessarily prolonged, and the space of time between the intent or knowledge to kill and the act of killing may be very short. The crime of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder requires proof, one, the defendant agreed with another, with one or more persons, that one of them or another person would engage in certain conduct, and two, the defendant intended to promote or assist in the commission of such conduct, and three, the intended conduct would constitute the crime of first-degree murder, and the defendant knew that such conduct was a crime. To prove a conspiracy, it is not necessary to show a formal meeting or an express agreement. A conspiracy may be inferred from circumstances showing a common criminal objective and does not require proof that all means set forth in the charging document were agreed upon or actually used, nor that every person involved was a member of the conspiracy. One may become a member of a conspiracy without full knowledge of all the details of the conspiracy. On the other hand, a person who has no knowledge of a conspiracy but happens to act in a way that furthers some object of the conspiracy does not thereby become a conspirator. Before you find that a defendant or any other person was a member of a conspiracy, the evidence must show beyond a reasonable doubt that the conspiracy was knowingly formed and that the defendant or other person knowingly participated in the unlawful plan with the intent to promote or assist the carrying out of the conspiracy. One who knowingly joins an existing conspiracy is as responsible as an originator or instigator of the conspiracy. A person understanding the unlawful character of a plan who knowingly encourages, advises, or assists the undertaking thereby also becomes a conspirator. In determining whether a conspiracy exists, you should consider the actions and statements of all the alleged participants. However, in determining whether a particular defendant was a member of the conspiracy, you should consider only that person's acts and statements. A person cannot be bound by the acts or statements of the other participants until it is established that a conspiracy existed and that person was one of its members. Intentionally or with the intent to means that a person's objective is to cause that result or to engage in that conduct. Intent may be inferred from all the facts and circumstances disclosed by the evidence. It need not be established exclusively by direct sensory proof. The existence of intent is one of the questions of fact for your determination. Knowingly, willfully, or new means that a person is aware or believes that his or her conduct is of that nature or that the circumstance exists. It does not require any knowledge of the unlawfulness of the act or omission. If the state is required to prove that the defendant acted knowingly, that requirement is satisfied if the state proves that the defendant acted intentionally. A defendant is criminally accountable for the conduct of another if the defendant is an accomplice of such other person in the commission of the offense, including any offense that is a natural and probable or reasonably foreseeable consequence of the offense for which the person was an accomplice. Accomplice means a person who, with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense, does any of the following. One, solicits or commands another person to commit the offense, or two, aids, counsels, agrees to aid, or attempts to aid another person in planning or committing the offense, or three, provides means or opportunity to another person to commit the offense. Act means bodily movement. The case will soon be submitted to you for your decision. When you go to the jury room, you will choose a foreperson. The role of the jury foreperson is important, but please remember that the foreperson's opinion about the case is not more important than that of the other jurors. The opinions of each juror count equally. The jury foreperson's responsibilities include the following. Make sure every member of the jury is present during the discussions and deliberations. Two, make sure that the deliberations are conducted respectfully and that all issues are fully discussed. The discussions should be open and free so that every juror may participate. Three, all jurors should be allowed to state their views about the case and what they think the verdict should be and why. Four, all members must agree unanimously on any verdict. Therefore, the foreperson should count the votes to ensure that every juror has voted. Five, if you reach a verdict, fill out the verdict form and then sign the form on behalf of the jury. Six, if the jury reaches a verdict, the foreperson will inform the courtroom assistant. When the jury returns to the courtroom, the foreperson will bring the signed or unsigned verdict form as well as any question forms that may have been used. Seven, when you return to the courtroom, the court will ask the foreperson whether the jury has reached any verdict. The foreperson will respond yes or no. The foreperson is not expected to read any verdict to the court. That will be done by the clerk. In just a few minutes, you will hear the closing arguments in this case. After that, the case will be submitted to you for decision. I suggest that you discuss and then set your deliberation schedule. You are in charge of your schedule and may set and vary it by agreement and the approval of the court. After you have decided on a schedule, please advise the courtroom assistant. You are to discuss the case and deliberate only when all jurors are together in the jury room. You are not to discuss the case with each other or anyone else during breaks or recesses. The admonition I have given you during the trial remains in effect when all of you are not in the jury room deliberating. After setting your schedule, I suggest that you next review the written jury instructions and verdict form. It may be helpful for you to discuss the instructions and verdict form to make sure that you understand them. Again, during your deliberations, you must follow the instructions and refer to them to answer any questions about applicable law, procedure, and definitions. Should any of you or the jury as a whole have any question for me during your deliberations or wish to communicate with me on any other matter, please utilize the jury question form that we will provide you. Your question or message must be communicated to me in writing and must be signed by you or the foreperson. I will consider your question or note and consult with the parties before answering it in writing. I will answer it as quickly as possible. Remember that you are not to tell anyone, including me, how you stand numerically or otherwise until after you have reached a verdict or have been discharged. During your deliberations, you must not communicate with or provide any information to anyone by any means about this case. You may not use any electronic device or social media to communicate to anyone any information about this case or to conduct any research about the case until I accept your verdict. 12 of you must agree on a verdict. You must be unanimous. Once all 12 agree on a verdict, only the foreperson need sign the verdict form on the line marked jury foreperson. You will be given one form of verdict. The verdict form reads as follows. There is no significance to the order in which the options of guilty and not guilty are listed on the verdict form. At the back, this is the sample verdict form. You'll get an official verdict form from the clerk. But this is the sample verdict, count one, conspiracy to commit first degree murder. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn in the above entitled action upon our oaths, do find the defendant, Lori Daybell, as to the crime of conspiracy to commit first degree murder occurring on or about October 2nd, 2019, as follows. Check only one, and the options are not guilty or guilty. The state can proceed with its closing argument.
Trey, you need a mic up there.
We're going to put a mic up on the podium.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that? Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious. New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.